If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Hey, everyone. Rachel Yucatel here from the Misunderstood podcast. Let's get real. How many of us feel consistently exhausted, struggling to focus with a to-do list that never ends? Trust me, I've been there. Recently, I've discovered something that's been a total game changer. Holistic Goddesses Bison Trifecta. It's a supplement made from freeze-dried bison organs, heart, liver, and kidney, all packed into convenient capsules. Since I started taking Bison Trifecta, my energy levels have soared and my mental clarity has never been better. It's been a lifesaver, especially as I navigate perimenopause and menopause. The best part, it's all natural with clean ingredients and no fillers. If you're looking for a boost, I highly recommend trying Bison Trifecta. And right now you can get 15% off with the code UNDERSTOOD at checkout. So go to holisticgoddess.com and learn more. HOLISTICGODDESS.com and use the code UNDERSTOOD. You won't regret it. Thank you for joining us back on Misunderstood. I am your host, Rachel Yucatel. I wanted to start today by thanking you so much for continually listening to my podcast, for hanging in there. I know that we have different guests that talk about completely different subjects, and sometimes they're not for everyone. And our numbers are growing on a consistent basis. We're getting so much interaction with people that write us, telling us that they may not have liked the person that we interviewed at the beginning or the topic, but once they started listening, they couldn't stop. And that's all I'm looking for. I'm looking for people to be open-minded and hear new opinions from possibly different people. So anyways, I wanted to thank you. If you're new here, please, welcome, but please subscribe, give us 5 stars, give us a review. It means so much. And if you're not new, again, thank you. But please let your friends know. We're always trying to grow. And anytime you leave a comment, we always look at it. So we really appreciate it. So today, I love this conversation, you guys, and I really hope you do too. So I have a guy here who I think is just so inspiring. Our guest today is named Mark Daly. He's a passionate advocate for LGBTQ+ parenting and an inspiring figure in the world of foster care and adoption. As a gay father who has navigated the challenges and triumphs of fostering and adopting children, Daly brings a deeply personal and insightly perspective to the subject. His experiences both as a foster and adoptive parent have shaped his understanding of family dynamics, resilience, and the importance of providing a safe and nurturing environment for children in need. His book out now, it's called Safe. Daly shares his journey of building a family through foster care and adoption, addressing the unique challenges faced by the LGBTQ+ individuals in the process. Through heartfelt storytelling and practical advice, he offers a guide not only for prospective foster and adoptive parents, but also for anyone seeking to understand the complexities of love, acceptance, and security in non-traditional family structures. In this discussion, we will explore the themes and insights Daly presents in Safe, diving into how his experiences shed light on the importance of creating safe, loving homes for children, regardless of their parents' sexual orientation. I really hope that you keep an open mind for this conversation. It's fantastic. He's fantastic. So please enjoy my conversation with Mark Daly. Mark, thank you for joining me today. I'm so happy that you're here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So as I told you before we started, I loved reading your book. It's not, I won't say it's like a beach read, but I read it on the beach.
Nice.
But I really couldn't put it down because, you know, this topic to me is, I have a child, my own child, but I've always been really interested in what it, you know, what goes into fostering, what goes into surrogacy. And, you know, there are people that go down different paths for different reasons. And, you know, you hear there's a lot of movies or stories about really terrible things that have happened in situations with foster. And so I was very interested to read your book from a person who has been through situations and come out the other end and knows a lot about it. So I want to jump right into it. I want to know from your perspective, and I know a lot of these questions I'm going to ask, I know the answers too, because I read the book, but I just want to, for our listeners who haven't read it yet, everyone should, it's called Safe. But I wanted to know why you chose to foster instead of getting a surrogate or anything like that.
Yeah. You know, my husband and I were newlyweds and we were trying to figure out how we wanted to start our family. And so I had three cousins who entered our family through foster care. And so I knew something about it. Now, granted, I was seven when the first one arrived. So, I mean, you really don't get a full knowledge of something at seven in that sense. But, you know, I was aware of it and I had done some work with a nonprofit in the foster care space. So I thought maybe some point I would foster. But we started going out, we're looking around and we met with a bunch of different surrogacy agencies. And we were pretty much like, you made our decision. We're gonna do surrogacy. That was it. And then we went down and we had breakfast with a friend of ours who happened to age out of the foster care system. And she's sort of this really awesome kid who just was schooling life. I mean, she was working on her master's, I think, now, at the time, or she was an undergrad at the time, I don't remember. But during the conversation, she said to us, you know, I was raised by women who, you know, who weren't my mother. And, you know, so I was raised really without my mother. And we thought, you know, our kid obviously will be raised without their mother as well, regardless of how we do that. Mm-hmm. She said, and while these women were amazing to me, I always felt like I came second because they always had biological children of their own first. Mm-hmm. And we thought, oh, well, you know, it was like, as soon as we left the breakfast, we got in the car and Jason, my husband, turned to me and he said, you know, maybe we should do foster first and then surrogacy afterwards. And I was like, you know, I agree with you. I think that's the right way to do it. And then, of course, when they came to our house, they said, you have a big house. Would you consider siblings? And then before you know it, you've got too many kids.
So can you explain the premise of fostering, though? Do people go into it thinking, oh, I'm only going to have this child for a short amount of time? Are they like, what's the mindset going into it?
So I think the way that it's supposed to be presented to people, honestly, is that it is a temporary thing. The idea is that a family is going through arguably the most difficult time of their life and their child, you know, is removed from them for whatever reason. And the goal at first is to keep them within their family or within their community, you know, an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent, a teacher, a friend. And if they can't find that, then it's a stranger. And that's really where foster care comes in that sense. And, you know, in California where I live, 55% of kids that enter foster care reunify. They go back to their birth parents. Goal is to help all kids go back to their birth parents, but that doesn't always happen. And in that event, usually after there's no family that's available or so on, then a foster parent becomes sort of first in line if they're interested in adopting. And that was sort of the process that we took, but we kind of went in thinking with that wrong mindset of like, oh, we'll just get there and we'll get this baby that, you know, has been left at the hospital or something, and we're going to be able to just take them home. And, you know, that was what we expected and not exactly what happened.
Right. So what are the stats? I mean, maybe you don't know them off the top of your head, but of children that are coming from foster that have been abused in some way, have gone through some sort of trauma, as opposed to kids who may not have been around the trauma, but their parents can't be, you know, there for them at the moment, like a young child or maybe a child who wasn't exposed to anything abusive.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I don't want to rattle off stats on top of my head because I will be lying to you if I do that. But, you know, the most common reason a child enters foster care is neglect. And what that is sort of, it's really an umbrella term that captures a lot of things. It's neglect maybe because of mental health issues for the parents or substance abuse issues for the parents. It's more often it's like those sort of things that are going on where the child is then neglected. You know, abuse is obviously plays a part in it as well.
Right.
You know, and even, you know, horrifically, even though I think agencies do their best to do background checks and weed out everything on anyone that's coming into foster, kids in foster care have reported, you know, a significant number of abuse by their caregivers while they're in care too, which is, right. You know, a horrifying stat.
Yeah, but you hear stories like that all the time, actually.
Yeah. And they do. I mean, I will say that agencies do their best to do background checks and screen. And I mean, the process you go through to become is intensive. It's not light. And that's by design. You
know? Yeah. Well, actually, let's get into that. What is the process of becoming a foster parent?
So it does vary wherever you live in the country. But where I am in California, it involves about, I think it was around 30 plus hours of in-class training, or they could do it now on Zooms and oftentimes, where you're learning things about trauma, abuse, neglect, like things like what to expect when you're expecting a kid in foster care, you know, and a lot of that covers things like ACEs, you know, like the adverse childhood experiences. So, you know, all of us experience different losses, like going to school for the first time or having a babysitter and your parents leaving the house for the first time. But kids in foster care experience things like maybe there's community violence or violence in the home or the death of a loved one or something that is unique to their personal experience. And those things, and then of course just the mere fact of being taken away from your biological parent,
that separation in and of itself,
it's entirely traumatic. And so, you know, we learn about that, and then they do a home inspection where they come over and they check out your house and they make sure you have you know, your prescription drugs are locked up, or your it's safe for the child to be there, it's clean, you know, your canned goods aren't 4 years old, whatever it is,
right?
You know, and you've got to be, there's some general standards, like you have to be able to support yourself so that you're not relying on the support that comes in from the, because you do get paid a tax-free stipend while you're fostering, but that's just to help supplement the cost of the child, not you.
Right.
So there's things like, there's some requirements.
Were there any, I don't want to say red flags, warnings that they would give you before you started that you should look out for, or, you know, things that you might, that might want to deter you from actually doing this?
Oh, I think there are a lot of things that might deter people from doing it, truthfully. I mean, you know, I wrote this book because I wanted to lift up these kids that are in the situation and their families, right? Mm-hmm. But ultimately, you know, people that I talk to now are like, I don't know if you talked me into it or out of it. And I was like, well, that's kind of my point, is I really wanted to be as transparent as possible so that if somebody were to come into this process, they're not shocked when something happens. You know, they understand, you know, for example, a child who's 8 years old that has been abused or witnessed abuse or witnessed violence in their home or in their community and all these different things, their emotional age is going to be a lot younger than their physical age. And so when they react to things, it's going to be different than the way that a typical 8 year old reacts. And you have to sort of be prepared for that and also have the grace and, you know, for them, where you're like, hey, you know, it's okay. This is, I get it. Like, I know why you're doing that, and be there and support them and have the patience and understanding. You know, I think that stuff is, some people are like, I don't know if I could do that, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Wait, I have a question, because I've always been, I've never understood how it works. You hear a lot, not always, but a lot about how children move from foster care to foster care to foster care. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily know that I've heard that people have been in foster for a huge amount of time. Now, why would someone move from one to the other? Is it because the fosters said, oh, I only want to do this 1 year at a time? I mean, obviously there are issues sometimes, behavioral issues or whatever. But can a foster parent be like, I don't want to do this anymore and get rid of them and ask for a new one?
They can. I mean, it's not, you know, it's, I think the goal is to try to make sure that that doesn't happen because you're obviously just reinforcing more trauma onto a kid with another move. It's another school. It's another set of friends. It's another, you know, set of caregivers and so on. So the goal is to not do that, right? But oftentimes, you know, kids will move and it can be a host of reasons, you know, things like maybe the foster parents took a job out of state and had to move. Or maybe the, you know, there's the biological parents are moved, you know, moved across the state or something like that. And they wanted them to be closer so they could, you know, continue to work on reunification, or they're moving, you know, where they're going to visit and you can't visit if you're several hours away or those sort of things. So it's just, there's a host of reasons, but sometimes just kids have different behavioral challenges too. That's usually, you know, 99% of the time.
Which is not shocking. Right. Because of where they're coming from. Hey, Misunderstood listeners, this episode is proudly brought to you by Lola V, an award-winning hair care line founded by the ever-fabulous, ever-iconic Jennifer Aniston. Ever feel like your hair just isn't living up to its potential? The secret might lie just beneath the surface. It starts in your scalp. That's right. Healthy, gorgeous hair starts with a clean, nourished scalp. And that's where Lola V's newest product, the Exfoliate and Detox Scalp Shampoo, comes in. This isn't your average shampoo. It's a two-in-one game changer, a scalp scrub and clarifying shampoo featuring a unique blend of activated charcoal powder, bamboo extract, and gentle AHAs to get rid of all that gunk weighing down your hair, leaving your scalp clean and perfectly balanced. Let's not forget those vegetable ceramides and B vitamins. They're there to soothe irritation and reduce flaking. Plus, with ingredients like alfalfa sprouts and pea peptides, you're on track to thicker, fuller looking hair. Love the science behind great hair care? Lola V's got you covered with their proprietary B-Pro 3 bond technology that ensures your locks are protected from damage. And the best part, this brilliance in a bottle is formulated for all hair types and textures, especially those dealing with dry, itchy scalps. And here is a treat for you, our awesome listeners. For a limited time, you get an exclusive 15% off your entire order at lolav.com. Just use the code Rachel, spelled R-A-C-H-E-L, at checkout. I mean, if you're taking any hair care advice, why not listen to anyone besides the woman who gave us the real Rachel? And one more time, I will just say, I absolutely love this new product. You've got to try it out, the Exfoliate and Detox Scalp Shampoo. I tried it and honestly, I felt a difference in my hair volume, and I use it with the intensive repair treatment. It's truly transformative. It's like a spa-like experience. So again, check out all the Lola V products on lolav.com. That's LOLAVIE.com. And as our loyal listeners, you get an exclusive 15% off your entire order when you use code Rachel at checkout, spelled R-A-C-H-E-L at checkout. Go to LOLAVIE.com with code Rachel. You know, it was interesting reading your book and hearing you say now too, that the goal of fostering is reunification with the parents, because, you know, from an outsider looking in, just when you read it in the news or whatever, it almost doesn't seem like they're working on the parents and getting them back with the kids for whatever reason. It seems like the kids are moving from one thing to the other, or they're trying to get out of a situation and then figure out when they could be adopted into a new, quote unquote, better family or better situation. So I think that's great that that's what the goal is. But like, what's the criteria for a family to be ready to take their child back?
You know, it's interesting. This was always sort of a sore spot for me, because the term that they called was minimum standard of care. Like, they need to be able to provide the minimum standard of care. And I thought, well, Rachel, your minimum standard and my minimum might be around the same, but they're probably not identical, right? There's different things and same, you know, so who's minimum in that sense? But it really, what it comes down to is, you know, that connection to their biological family, that sense of belonging we all have with where we come from, is really powerful. And I think, you know, there are a lot of things that are put in place. You know, oftentimes there's court ordered, you know, rehabilitation, you know, drug or alcohol rehab, like things like that, that are, you know, making sure they're going to, the parents are getting whatever mental health support they need from a psychiatrist if they have, you know, schizophrenia or bipolar or whatever, you know, whatever these mental health issues are, that they're getting the resources they need to address that. And then they're doing visitations. Sometimes they have to take parenting classes, anger management. It really depends what, you know, each situation is so different. And I think mm-hmm. that was the one thing that really stuck out to me, was that, you know, there is no one size fits all approach to, like, how do you help a family that's struggling, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So now I want to talk about your situation. When you first learned you were getting these two brothers, tell me about that and what that was like.
Yeah. So we, you know, I had jokingly said, yeah, we take two kids, thinking it meant like if mom had a baby 3 years down the road, could they call us? You know, I didn't realize that meant, you know, we would get two at the same time. It was just my own naivety, like, honestly. You know, and we had heard stories of people where, like, mom went outside to smoke a cigarette at the hospital and never returned. And so we thought that's what we would get, you know, this like slam dunk case, because they knew we wanted to adopt. And truthfully, what they were thinking was, here are two guys that are willing to take, you know, more than one kid under the age of three. So let's, you know, and they got a big house, let's do it. You know, so we were like, all right. So when they called, you know, we had both sort of cleared our calendars where we were going to be home, no traveling, like that entire month of June. And everyone else in our group of foster parents that all went through class training and approval and stuff, that we all had the same due date, you know, I was calling it. And they all got placement within like 36 hours of being, you know, June 1st, their phones just started blowing up. And for us, nothing happened. And like 2 weeks went by, and I had one day that I had said I would travel. I had to go give a speech at Stanford, and it was like the one day that I had committed to, like a year and a half. And of course, that was the day the call came in. So when I like leave a meeting, there's like 7 missed text messages, 9 missed calls from Jason, and, you know, the phone number we had, the Google phone number we had set up for all our calls. Anyway, when I came out, he was like, you know, they've got two little boys that 3 months and 13 months old. You know, they needed to know hours ago, what do you think? And that was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon when they called. At 5 o'clock, the two boys were at our house, and I didn't get home till after 10 that night.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. My gosh. So, okay. So what was that like the first day, the first night? How does that happen?
It was so crazy. I mean, you know, these kids show up, they have no, like, it's not like, you know, like an adult shows up with like a driver's license, maybe a birth certificate. We didn't have any of that stuff. And all I could think to myself is, like, if there's an emergency, I take them to the hospital, they're going to think I kidnapped them. Like, this is so weird. There was no like real identification paperwork sort of thing. But, you know, I got home that night from Stanford, and I walk in the kitchen, and there's like just baby bottles and toys and all this stuff just like thrown all over the kitchen. There's a high chair in the corner that's like covered in food that wasn't there in the morning. You know, because when you're going for foster care and you say 0 to 3, 0 to 3 is a big range. You know, yeah. I mean, you bring a baby home from the hospital, you know, you need some onesies, maybe some bottles or, you know, some swaddle stuff. But in our case, it was like, do we need sippy cups or do we need bottles? Are we on pacifiers still? Like, you know, so
diapers,
we didn't
yeah.
stock up. Yeah, what size diapers, right? I mean, there's so many things to factor in that we, you know, hadn't even thought of. So it was pure pandemonium, but it was also amazing. Coincidentally,
so Jason had to handle it for the first couple hours by himself.
Oh yeah. We had my cousin lives nearby. She was there helping out. And then another friend went to Target for and bought a whole bunch of stuff for us. And, you know, and then his parents just coincidentally had been flying in that night. And so they got in, you know, well after I got home that night. And then, you know, they stayed with us for about a week or so, just for a pre-planned visit, but perfect timing. So it was really amazing because they were there with us. And then we have just a big community of friends and support, you know, that system that was around us that really stepped up, and it was amazing.
And how much background did you have on these two children?
Really nothing. We knew, you know, that they were 3 months old and 13 months old. But although the first time they called, we thought that they were Latino twins. So we really didn't know. And they were, you know, two little boys with, you know, blonde and strawberry long hair, you know, it's like the game of telephone, you know, when they call you to see if you'll take this. And so you're asking all these questions, but they don't really know all the answers. Right. You know, we knew that they had a mom and a dad. We knew that the parents had been told there were, you know, there were a lot of things they had to do, that they had an older sibling who was adopted out, which typically means when you have a sibling who is adopted out, the odds aren't as likely that they're going to reunify. And since, you know, we were really hoping to get in a situation with kids who were young, who were probably not going back, it felt like this was sort of a safe choice for us, you know?
Yeah. What was that like living though in that middle ground of not knowing if these could be your kids or if you had to love them as much as you can, but almost keep a distance because you know you're going to have to give them back? I mean, I just know with fostering a dog, it's terribly hard to give up the dog to anyone else to be like, they can't take care of this dog the way that I can. So I can't imagine not knowing, you know, if like how this is going to turn out. It would just be terrible.
Yeah, that was something that I was not at all prepared for. I think in my head, I had baby fever and I thought these kids are going to arrive, they're going to be ours and that's it. And then all of a sudden, you know, the rubber meets the road, you know, it's like, all right, so now we go through this and we have a court date and, you know, 6-8 months, whatever it was, and we'll find out what's happening there. And then, you know, they get continued for another 6 months. And then you're just living in this gray area of like, what if, are they going home? Are they staying? And you're sort of in your head guessing like, all right, well, you know, the mom went into a rehab, but then she dropped out of the rehab. So wait, was that, you know what I mean? And of course you're not in, and I want to make sure your listeners know, like when I'm doing this, you know, you start to see the parents and you get to hear their stories from them, you know, because you're monitoring visits with them and you get to see all that they've been through or just whatever they're willing to share, you know, what they open up about. And, you know, you're in a way you're rooting for them because you'd be heartless to not root for them, right? Like, I mean, that would just be evil to root against somebody. And so you are rooting for them, even though you know that's going to break your own heart. But you also have to be there because and give 100% of your heart to these kids because that's what they need, you know?
It's so interesting that you say that, though, because I just feel like I can imagine there would be a lot of animosity, that the birth parents would be angry and jealous that somebody else was now raising their kids and someone like you and your husband might look at it in a different light of not being judgmental, but just being like, oh my God, there's no way that these people can take care of these children, seeing what they're like. So, I mean, I think obviously what your compassion, and I know from your husband having some issues in the past and being able to understand them and be empathetic, that probably really helped the situation at the time create, you know, some sort of relationship. I mean, talk about the relationship that you had.
Without a doubt, you know, it's funny. It's like what you don't think about in foster care or in adoption in general, like private adoption, is that all adoptions start with a loss, right? You know, we think about that moment with the judge and the courthouse and the balloons and all your family and friends and loved ones cheering you on as this adoption happens. But we never think about, in order to get there, a child had to be removed from their family.
Yeah.
You know, whether that was by the parents' choice or by the decision of a court or, you know, the government. So it's all adoption starts with loss. And I think that's the hardest part. And, you know, the first day the boys, they got in the first day and then the next day we got a phone call from their grandmother who they had been living with for a little bit of time. And, you know, I think that was the first time that I realized it. Like for us, all of a sudden there was a face on the end of it, you know, and it was really, you know, and we started talking and Jason, my husband, was so, you know, casual about it, just letting her know that these kids were, you know, already loved and provided for and cared for and, you know, they were in good hands. And you could just hear in her voice as she started to cry and she's like, I'm just so grateful. She's like, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen when somebody enters foster care and where they're going to end up. And so really it's a touching moment, but it's also, it's hard to, you know, your heart breaks for her because you know what she's going through, you know? Yeah. And then when we met the birth parents, it's similar. I mean, I think they were very, I think she had said, you know, look, they're with you guys and the guys are crazy about them and they're doing, you know, they're taking good care of them. And we had met her before we met with the parents as well in person. And I think that message was relayed to them. So they were actually like very appreciative and like, I can't thank you enough. And, you know, but I sort of went in thinking it would be the same way that you were mentioning it. Like, you know, here's two guys. We obviously aren't going to have a child biologically. So they know that adoption is something we're looking to do. Mm-hmm. Would they be threatened? And I don't think they felt that way at all. I think they felt more like, you know, we were sort of doing them a favor.
Yeah. You know? Obviously, I want people to read your book, but can you get into the story a little bit about then how you learned
that
the children were going to go back to their parents?
Yeah, absolutely. So after about, you know, over almost a year and a half or so, the court was ruling in favor of them staying with us for another 6 months. And at that point, I had in my head that, look, they're probably going to go home, but I don't really know. And they're not ready at this point. The parents were both in rehab centers. They had had another child who was allowed to stay with them at the rehab center. And so, so they were making some progress, but there was still things like every time they were with them, they really didn't pay any attention to the younger of the two boys. It was like almost as if they were like afraid to talk to him or not. They were just sort of indifferent in some way.
Yeah. Maybe they didn't. They felt like they didn't know him, kind of.
I'm sure in part that was it. I mean, they'd only had him for, you know, about maybe 6 weeks before he was taken. And then he went to live with the grandmother before they came to us. So there was a lot of that. Right. And then I think, you know, then that court ruled that way. But we had been told early on that the mother had, you know, the pro bono attorney that was given to her when the boys were detained had asked her if she wanted to appeal the decision to have the boys detained from her. And she did. And we were told that, you know, everybody appeals. It's just standard practice, but nobody ever wins. Don't even give it another thought. And so we really didn't. And it turns out she won her appeal. And so we found this out a few days after that court ruling that would have had them with us for about 6 more months. And so we sort of went into this tailspin of like, all right, they might be ready to go home in 6 months. They might not, but they're certainly not now. And so you could see this like mad scramble on behalf of, you know, the county agency where they were trying to get more visits in and they were trying to get them to spend more time with each other because at this point it was out of their hands. And I think they knew the same thing we knew, but no one else was willing to say it but us. You know, and there was a nonprofit that we had worked with that, you know, was definitely aligned with us on this too, but it was really, it was hard just because you didn't know what's going to happen. And then if they go home, it was never about, you know, can this family love them or another sort of, it's like, but can they keep them safe? You know, and that was my fear.
Talk about, I've heard you mention about the judge and you didn't feel like the judge really knew the players in the case. And there was so much work that seemed to go into it with the caseworkers about getting the paperwork done and getting the facts in. But then it seemed like the judge didn't really pay attention to any of that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, it was just interesting. It was like one day we're sitting in court, you know, with the family, and then 6 months later, we're back there. And this time they have another baby and she's, you know, bouncing the baby in her lap. And the judge says, oh, who's this? And I'm just thinking to myself, I'm like, wait, you don't know that they had another kid? Like, it was just so like, so you're about to rule whether or not they can have three kids under the age of three. And you don't know that. I mean, you were only thinking about the two. You didn't realize like this, there was this new wild card thrown in here.
Right.
It's just like, I was like, where is the breakdown in communication? You know, I mean, how many cases are going through this judge's office that he can't follow it? I mean, it seemed awful. You know, it was just too much.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask like what you've learned about this system. I mean, do you think they're too overwhelmed? There's too many kids going through the system that people's stories really aren't being heard. I mean, do you think the kids are safe? Do you think they are being protective?
No, God, that's a really hard question. Cause I think that, I think there's probably too many kids coming in or kids that are coming in needlessly. Right. Because I think we over surveil certain communities, especially communities of color in this country, and we over police them. And as a result, we're taking in more kids that are Black, Brown, Indigenous than we should be. And we're overlooking other kids that maybe are being neglected too.
Right.
So I think that is a problem. That being said, I think that one of the biggest, you know, falsehoods we have is that neglect is poverty. And, you know, lots of kids grow up or adults have grown up in poverty and go on to do wonderful things. And, you know, it's a loving home doesn't have to be rich, you know, but we could do a lot more to help families that are struggling that, you know, to make ends meet, to feed their children, to keep a roof over their head. Families that want the help and that are willing to, you know, that are able to to care for their kids absolutely should. And I think too often poverty is a reason kids are taken away from their families.
Right. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned what you just were saying about how some kids are taken away needlessly and other kids are completely overlooked. I think when you look at the news, at least where I live, you know, I live in between New York and Florida, and there are so many stories about kids who have died at the hands of their parents because they were neglected, left at home in a playpen while mother goes on vacation. Parents who are keeping their children in a box and in their house, not feeding them. I mean, terrible situations. And then also there's a situation like, I don't know if you're familiar with Maya Kowalski, where she was a girl who was CPS came in and took her. She became awarded to the estate, because her parents brought her into the hospital and asked for them to give her ketamine to help a sickness she had. And they blamed the parents and thought the parents were trying to make their daughter sick and all this. And needless to say, the mother ended up killing herself because she was so upset that they wouldn't allow her to see her child. And later on, just this past year, Johns Hopkins had to pay over $220 million to the family for wrongfully taking the child away from the parent. So, I mean, it's just terrible stories like this on either side. And I personally know, I think at least three families that have told me about how they bring their kid into the hospital and they're asked a series of questions and they almost thought they were about to get in trouble. Like, you know, a friend of mine who had their kid had taken, you know, when you make mac and cheese and it's the hot water in the. And the kid was four and had taken the little dish out of the microwave and spilled hot water all over his chest and you know, got third degree burns or whatever. And the hospital blamed the parents and it was a terrible situation. And when it was a complete accident. So, you know, there are just so many incompetent caregivers, you know, in that area. Yeah. Not caregivers, excuse me, but caseworkers in that area that are not paying attention to the facts. Can you talk about competent versus incompetent?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like just thinking about that situation, it's one of those where that you were just talking about. It's one of those where, you know, you kind of do have to ask those questions, though, because if God forbid it was a child abuse situation and they left the kid in there. But on the flip side, it's like accidents do happen. Like, so, it's important that they differentiate between which one is an accident and which is intentional. And that's, you know, but yeah, it's really hard. You know, we had a bunch of social workers that we worked with throughout our case and, you know, all but one were very good and great at their job, you know? And I'm very candid in the book about the one that wasn't, but the situation for us was, and these caseworkers oftentimes have too many cases. You know, we had one social worker, I called her Kendra in the book. She had over 45 cases. You know, there was a day when the older boy had fallen, like he just tripped and banged his head. And so of course we ran him to the ER and did everything that we were supposed to do. And you know, she didn't call me back for 3 days. And this was early on after they got there. And I was thinking like, oh God, I can't believe this is what it is. This is what, you know, social workers, they stink, you know? And then I was like, oh, When I finally heard from her, she was like, hey, look, I'm really sorry. You know, it was the weekend and I had, you know, I have 45 current cases. And she wasn't being defensive, by the way, either. She was like, I have 45 cases right now. She's like, and I was actually chasing two kids that were on an Amber Alert right now. So I knew, you know, she's like, I have all these open cases with all these different kids in different houses. And I don't leave your house and then worry about the safety of the boys. Like, you know, I know that you and Jason are competent and they're going to be taken care of. And I'm not I trust that. And so yours aren't the ones I'm worried about.
Yeah.
And which made me feel good about, you know, her having her vote of confidence. But then I was also like, oh God, I'm such a fool for not, you know, recognizing that she has so much work. She's so overworked. And that's when you think about how does stuff fall through the cracks? It's like, I get it. Like on for situations like her, like if she were to lose something through the cracks, you have to give her the grace because she's overworked. You know, there's not enough social workers, you know, doing what she's doing.
Yeah. Can we go back for a second and just talk about what that was like the first night that after you had given the kids back and you were at home alone with Jason, was that terribly sad? Were you happy that they were reunited? How did you feel?
No, we weren't happy. And the reason is, honestly, we felt like they were going home to a house that was not prepared for them. And we knew that something was going to happen. And it was just, I wanted more than anything for those boys to just be safe. It wasn't even about, you know, can they give them this or that, or, you know, are they going to be able to afford to send them to college, or, you know, the opportunities and that sort of things. It was more about, like, you know, are there lights on, you know, covers on the electric outlets? You know, are they going to have enough food? Are the, you know, the dad had showed some anger at times, and I was like, is that going to be directed at them? You know, and it just, there were things like that where I was like, this is so horrifying. You know, I remember that one of the social workers came, and she got the boys, and we, you know, loaded them into her car. And then, you know, Jason looked at me like, let's just go for a walk. And like, we just walked down the street, we got ice creams, we sat on a bench, you know, and it was just sad, you know. Yeah.
And what are you allowed to do in terms of communication with the family after the fact? Do they tell you you can't speak? Do they let you speak? Do they let you see the kids again?
No, and when they went back, you know, we were in a good place with the parents. You know, we had a good relationship with them. And so we were told and encouraged, you know, like, look, stay in our lives. Like, let them know if they need anything, call you. Like, mm-hmm. If the dad has some anger issues and he's, you know, about to have a fit or something, like, let him know to call you and you'll come get the kids and give them some respite care. Like, be their friends in that sense. And so we tried really hard to do that, you know, for a while. We had, you know, we had gone over and brought them some food one night. We brought them over. We had some other more, we had so much clothes and toys and stuff like that we had gotten for them over the year and a half that they were with us that obviously were theirs. So we wanted to bring them to them. And yes, we brought those over and we'd gone and visited a couple times. And then there was a situation where we took them to the hospital one night because the oldest one had a bad fever. You know, we had a car. So we drove the mom and the three kids to the hospital and went with her. And then while they were in getting him care, I took the younger son over to the grocery store. We bought them some more food and then brought them all home. We left the house that night. It was a Friday night. And the grandmother said that she was going to go down on Saturday. And so she went in and hung out and did some laundry and other things and spent the night. And then on that Sunday, the grandmother called us. And she was hysterical. And I was, you know, what's going on? And she said, I had just run down to the store. And when I came back, the mom was outside smoking a cigarette. And the daughter, who was then 10 months old, and the younger son, who was then 20 months old, were in the tub by themselves.
Oh, my God.
You know, and I mean, and that was my fear. And so, you know, what we ended up doing was I had gotten to know the guy who runs the Department of Children and Family Services here in LA. And I just threw some work stuff. And so I sent him an email because it was like, I knew I couldn't go to our social worker because we had the one that I didn't think was very competent at the time. And so I emailed him and just said, you know, look, I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. You know, I didn't see this. So, you know, I'm reporting what someone else told me, but I'm not confident that if I said anything to the social worker, anything would change. But I knew hitting send on that email also meant that we'd be costing ourselves a relationship with them. Mm-hmm. And I also knew that if I didn't do it, I would never live with myself if something happened. Mm-hmm. So ultimately we hit send and then we heard from the mother that she never wanted to hear from us again.
Right. So now if you spool later on, they do lose their kids again. Correct. As of today, what's the situation with those children?
Yeah, I know. So what happened was we waited because we knew that they were going to come back in. It was just I was like, let's just not do anything and let's give it time because they're going to come back in. And the truth is they really didn't come in contact with anyone who was mandated to report for a little over a year. And then ultimately, I'm sorry, probably even longer than that, but a little over a year after they reunified, we ended up finding out about three kids who were in a foster situation that weren't going home. And they said they were looking for a permanent family for them. The family that they were with just foster parents, and they couldn't adopt for whatever reason. And so
how long had those three been in foster at that point?
A little over a year.
Okay.
They actually went into care right about the same time the boys left our care. And so we had no kids for, you know, maybe a year, I don't know, middle of a year.
I just had a question about this. In that situation, what made it that the kids were then available for adoption as opposed to going home? Tell me specifically.
So the always give you a reunification plan. The parents have to meet a certain threshold and they have to do certain things in order to get there. And after, you know, so much time, which the court will give more time if the parents are making progress, right? But it, because they really hadn't done anything, they terminated the services and said, let's look for a permanent placement. And wow. So that was about after a year. And so then we found out about them and we're like, well, let's just find out the story. You know, let's see what's going on. And then we found out the story. We of course met them and fell in love immediately. And then we started doing visits with them and then they started doing weekend overnights. And then ultimately they moved in. And then about 10 months later, we got a call from the county that the boys and their younger sister were now in care. And would we take them as well, which would have given us 6 children.
Wow.
Which I, you know, 6 children who are all wonderful, amazing kids, but each one has their own challenges, of course. And we just didn't feel like as 2 of us, we would be able to give them everything that they need. And so ultimately we made the decision not to, which was truthfully the hardest decision of my life.
Yeah. You know? Sure. And so are they still in foster care? Did they get adopted? What's their situation?
No, they've been in and out a few times. And right now they're living with their dad, you know, and the mom is not in that equation anymore. I don't really get updates that often. You know,
so you don't communicate with them now?
Not regularly, no.
But also that probably would have been difficult for the 3 kids that you were now committing to have another community come into the picture.
I think so. But, you know, we have a thing in our house. I mean, I think it's very important to be honest with one another, you know, with everybody in life. But I think it's, you know, especially with kids, you know, what we find kids who've experienced trauma is that, and you know, like I said, being removed from your family is traumatic in and of itself, that if you don't tell them their own story, they make it up. And whatever they make up is going to be worse than the truth anyways. And mm-hmm. So, you know, we luckily have amazing psychiatrists that my kids work with and my husband and I work with as well. And it's really helpful, you know, for all of us. And I think so the same thing is like when writing this book, you know, I don't share a tremendous amount of their backstory because I think that's their story to tell. Where the boys, I changed all their identities and anything identifiable, so you don't know, you wouldn't be able to track them down.
Right.
You know, so it's a little bit different there. But I'll let you know. Mike is going to share their story later, you know, if they want to.
What was that like getting the call that the adoption went through, or how does that work?
You know, it was really funny because we had them with us. It had been, you know, a little over a year that we were moving towards adoption. And what they really do is once you move in, it's like a pre-adoptive placement. You've got to live with them for 6 months before they'll start your adoption paperwork because they want to make sure that it's a fit, right? The worst thing would be an adoption that they'd have to cancel out, right?
Yeah.
And so after 6 months, they started that process. And then so little over a year, the global pandemic broke out. And so that was, you know, in May of that year was when we were supposed to have our adoption date. But because the courts were closed and then the courts were mine and then, you know, they ended up just doing paperwork and sending it to us. So about a week before Christmas that year, we just got a, you know, letter in the mail. It was like, here you go. Congratulations. So it was anticlimactic.
Oh, it wasn't like you see in social media where people are running in slow motion. You're now adopted.
Not at all. Okay. Not at all. Yeah, it was for us, it was pretty magical. I will say, you know, the pandemic for as awful as it was for the world and everybody living with it and those who died from it, you know, for my family being locked in the house together for a year, knowing that we didn't have those first few years of their life with them, it was pretty beautiful. I mean, we all got to see where we fit in the family and build bonds that we otherwise wouldn't have been as deep, you know?
Right. Did they ask a lot of questions about their parents? Was there a lot of separation anxiety? Do they miss them? Do they, you know, what's their relationship with their birth parents?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, we do have communication with them. So it's not as like, it's, you know, it's not as regular. It's more like holidays, birthdays, stuff like that. It's not, you know, we don't see them, but we, you know, over phone communication and stuff. They've got some stuff that they're dealing with. So, you know, the parents, so we've sort of give them space to, you know, and we'll be in touch when they're in touch sort of thing.
Right. What would you say is the biggest lesson that you learned from your experiences in the last couple of years with fostering versus adoption, everything you've gone through?
Yeah, I mean, in addition to all of the basic parent things that we all learned as parents, you know,
yeah.
I think that one of it is really just the ability of your heart to love. I mean, that it really is, there is no limit. You know, I mean, when those boys left, I thought I would never be able to love another child, you know, and then I met three more who just added more space in my heart that I didn't know was available. I think that's probably the biggest thing.
Yeah. And for anyone thinking about fostering, what would you suggest? Are there any things that you want to say to them?
I think it's the biggest thing is to go in with your eyes wide open, right? And it's this idea that you are for yourself, it's like understanding that like there's a strong likelihood that your kid's going to reunify. So if you're not up for that, you know, there's other things you can do, you know, become a mentor, become a CASA, do other things, right? But if you have it in your heart to do this and you have the ability, then like know that you got to go in and give this kid the love and attention they need. And at times it's not going to be easy, like because parenting's not easy, but parenting a kid with trauma has definitely got some added challenges to it. But it also, I mean, the reward is just so amazing.
Right.
So it's, you know,
I encourage being able to help a kid in need when you know, have so much or maybe you don't even realize how much you have, but it means so much to them. I mean, I just think it's such a beautiful, magical thing. So I hope that there are more people that want to foster. I think a lot of people haven't even thought about it. They don't even know that they could be helpful, but it seems like there are so many children in need. And so it would be something for people to definitely look into. Tell people where they can find the book and where they can look up more about you.
Yeah, absolutely. So Safe, it's a memoir of fatherhood, foster care, and the risks we take for family is available wherever books are sold. My website is markdaly.us. And then if you're interested in fostering, I did set up a site called thefosterparent.com, which connects people to agencies in their own community where they can get involved.
Amazing. Mark, thank you so much. I wish you guys the best of luck and a great birthday today.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast.gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time. Understood.